interesting discussion after the break. So let's have a short break and we'll see you after the break.
يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي الخيرات
إمام علي عليه السلام said excessive blame causes the fire of obstinacy to flame.
Dear listeners, welcome back. So we were discussing a very important issue and very interesting issues regarding the Islamic upbringing of our children, especially our teenage children, teenage boys and girls.
I would love to hear some sayings of Masumin from you. That would be so much, you know, beneficial for all of us.
I was just reading a hadith from Imam Ali alayhi salam, our mm-hmm. first imam. Although this hadith is for general people regarding taghafun, so Imam Ali alayhi salam says in this hadith, it is a long hadith, just I will read the, you know, last line. فَإِنِّي وَجَدْتُ جَمِيعَ مَا يَتَعَايَشُ بِهِ النَّاسُ وَبِهِ يَتَعَاشَرُونَ مِلْءَ مِكْيَالٍ ثُلُثَاهُ إِسْتِحْسَانٌ وَثُلُثُهُ تَغَافُلٌ. You know, whatever people interact with, you know, whatever people do in their lives are three quarters, you know. Two quarters is istihsan, being kind towards others, toward your family, toward your children, toward your, you know, whatever, whoever belongs to you. And one third is taghaful. It means in this hadith, Imam Ali says, whole your life is summarized by three things. Two of them is istihsan, being kind.
Okay.
And one third is taghafun.
Wow, very interesting.
If you apply in this beautiful hadith in your life, you will see you have so much peaceful life.
Ease and comfort. And you can just tackle the things very easily.
Yeah. So in general, your life, and especially regarding your teenage sons and daughters, you know, if you use this, the principle of taghaful, ignoring, then you will see so many fruits of this beautiful hadith.
Wow. And you know, some ahadith which I have read about this beautiful principle is that, you know, the sign of having aql, you know, if you are intellectual, that means you should have taghaful. If you can't ignore in areas where we have to ignore, that means you are not enough intellectual. Yeah, you are not using the light of your intellect. And one more thing which I really want to focus is that what is the benefit of taghaful? Okay, you know, for example, if I'm asking my son, yes, Ali, have you prayed? And he said, yeah, mom, I have prayed right now. And then, you know, I'll go and I'll check. I'll say, oh, I'm 100% sure that he didn't pray.
Done,
yeah, 100%, I'm sure, 100%. And then if I say, I know you didn't pray, you are just lying to me. You know, one reaction. Second reaction is that I'm just ignoring. If I don't ignore, yeah, ignore doesn't mean that I'm not thinking about solving
solution,
that problem.
Yeah.
You know, there are, inshallah, there are so many details about it. We'll talk later on. So if I'm just ignoring that point, why? Then, you know, Ali, for example, my son, he will think that, oh, why he was lying? Why he was saying, mom, I have prayed? Because he was thinking that me as Ali, yeah, my position in the eyes of my mother is as a person who prays on time, okay? So he wanted to keep that position in his mother's eyes by just not practicing the taghaful. I'm just, you know, destroying all the hopes, you know, all that respectful curtain which was between me and my child. So I'm harming him. I'm harming, destroying his personality. Because if I'm shying, if I'm hiding something, that means I want to tell that person, no, I'm still musalli. I'm still a prayer. I pray, you know, I do my salah. So, like, I usually give this example that if I'm wearing a very neat, tidy, you know, clothes, new, so I take care of that, my dress. But the moment I see there's any kind of drop on it, has become dirty, then I don't care. The same thing, the child is thinking that I'm very clean in front of my parents. So he's taking care of his cleanliness. Sometimes he does mistakes. But if you just say, I know you are a liar, so now he say, I will not care. You know, you're destroying his personality and the method of this training.
Wow, such a beautiful example. Inshallah, we will continue and we will have more examples like this in our upcoming episodes, inshallah. Dear listeners, thank you for joining us on the program. If you have any suggestions, comments, or questions, you can contact us at our email, englishradio@irib.ir. And you can visit our website also, parstoday.com. Until next episode, fi amanillah.
Islam solves all of its problems. Allah leaves no stone unturned. Perfect with no flaws at all are the laws of Allah. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
The United States' close ties with some of the regimes in West Asia, especially its support for oil-rich Persian Gulf Arab rulers, have long been blamed for many of the problems in this part of the world. A case in point is Saudi Arabia, which is controlled by an autocratic regime with a notorious human rights record. It never gets even a slap on the wrist for its violations of human rights inside the kingdom and its destabilizing actions in the region. Saudi Arabia's war on Yemen has created the world's worst humanitarian disaster. Even when Saudi airstrikes hit markets, weddings, schools, or hospitals, killing large numbers of civilians, the war gets little attention on Western news channels and no criticism from the White House. Later this month, it will be the 6th anniversary of the beginning of the Saudi-led offensive against its southern neighbor. The U.S. is definitely a partner in this aggression. For most of the war, the U.S. military provided support, including intelligence and logistics for the Saudis and their Emirati allies. In response to the ongoing Saudi-led bombardment, the Yemenis have been learning to hit back with missile strikes and drone operations. And this is definitely angering the Saudis and their supporters, who have loudly condemned Yemeni retaliatory attacks. Such stances, especially by the United States, have drawn fierce criticism. The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has slammed the U.S. for distorting the truth about what is happening in the region. The Ansarullah's capabilities to hit Saudi targets with high precision are improving fast. Ansarullah's arsenal of new weapons, including projectiles and drones, has become a major headache for the Saudis nearly 6 years after they began the war to defeat the popular forces. The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution slammed the U.S. and the United Nations on Thursday for condemning the Yemenis whenever they managed to retaliate against Saudi Arabia. The Iranian leader says the UN is even acting worse than the U.S., as the world body has failed to criticize Saudi Arabia for pounding Yemen for 6 years. Ayatollah Khamenei also had tough words for the U.S. for failing to act on the murder of dissident journalist Jamal Khashoggi in 2018. The leader said Washington is turning a blind eye to the gruesome assassination and keeps up its support for the Saudi regime and still claims to be a supporter of human rights. The administration of U.S. President Joe Biden is widely under fire for deciding not to punish the Saudi leadership despite the recent release of an intelligence report that shows Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman approved the 2018 assassination. The Biden administration has concluded that directly penalizing Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman would risk damaging American interests. Before taking office, Biden had promised to take a very tough line on the kingdom over its human rights violations. But so far, Biden seems to have done too little to keep that promise.
Virtually nowhere has Biden done anything to change his policies. I don't think that that's going to happen. The fact is that American policy making happens in the corridors of power, behind the scenes, and the presidents, essentially, whether they're Democrat or Republican, do as they're told. They do as the money mafia in the background tell them, or the system, the systemic, if you like, backdrop, which is there. And Ayatollah Khamenei has kind of pointed to this, that the system, whether it's the United Nations, whether it's the World Bank, whether it's the American government, whether it's, whether it's even the likes of WHO, there is an international network of, if you like, levers of power, which are used to make sure that all and sundry follow exactly what they're told to do.
In 2015, Iran and the P5+1 group of countries, the U.S., the U.K., France, Russia, and China, plus Germany, signed a nuclear deal known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or the JCPOA. The deal limited Iran's atomic program that allowed the International Atomic Energy Agency to inspect the country's nuclear facilities more freely. However, despite Iran being fully committed to the deal, the former U.S. President Donald Trump unilaterally withdrew from the accord back in 2018, reimposing anti-Iran sanctions that have been lifted by the deal. The new U.S. administration of President Joe Biden has signaled its willingness to rejoin the JCPOA, yet it has conditioned the move on Tehran's resumption of its commitments under the 2015 deal. However, Tehran says that Washington must take the first step, as it walked away from the deal back in 2018.
Since the U.S. backed out of the deal, it should take the first step. The one that broke the deal must return to it sooner and knows that Iran is ready to fulfill its commitments.
1 year after Washington's withdrawal from the deal, Tehran began scaling down its nuclear commitments. Tehran says this move is in line with the 2015 nuclear deal and a response to the failure of the remaining signatories to fulfill their commitments. The top Iranian security official has ruled out any step-for-step return to the 2015 nuclear deal. He has said that Iran will resume its JCPOA commitments only if the U.S. removes its unilateral sanctions. The Iranian official said not until the sanctions are lifted will Tehran hold talks with Washington. Such a stance was the theme of the remarks made by Iran's leader, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, during a speech last month. And during his speech in February, Ayatollah Khamenei stressed that Iran will never bow down to U.S. pressures over its nuclear program.
So when the United States says now, under Joe Biden, we want to go back to the JCPOA, but Iran must do this and that. In fact, what happens, what comes after the but is irrelevant, because there should be no ifs, ands, and buts in this entire story. It is, the fact of the matter is that the United States withdrew, they reinstated sanctions, so now if the United States wants to come back to the JCPOA, they have to come back, lift all sanctions, and go back to the way the JCPOA was signed.
Israel is the most worried about a possible revival of the 2015 nuclear deal between Iran and the world powers. It believes that Iran is after its destruction, an accusation that Iran has rejected. After all, it has been Israel who has threatened Iran with military action time and again. For example, just days ago, Israeli jets escorted U.S. B-52 bombers in the region as a signal to Iran. B-52 bombers usually carry nuclear bombs, which makes it very ironic that the U.S. and Israel would send this signal to Iran, who is pursuing a civilian nuclear program. Last week, the Israeli Minister of Military Affairs, Benny Gantz, told Fox News that Tel Aviv is updating its plans for striking Iranian nuclear sites, and that Israel has identified numerous targets inside of Iran. In response to Gantz's threat, Iran's defense minister, Brigadier General Amir Hatami, said that Tehran would raise Tel Aviv and Haifa if Israel committed any mistake.
Any nation that stands in the way of global U.S. hegemony will be subjected to a massive soft war series of attacks, massive propaganda campaign that is used to justify potential military action or at least military threats. And this is something we see now regarding Iran.
Israel has also gone through great lengths to set back Iran's civilian nuclear program, including the assassination of the top Iranian nuclear scientist, Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, in November 2020. The Israel regime has constantly accused Iran of attempting to develop a nuclear arsenal. That is while Tel Aviv is the only possessor of nuclear weapons in the region. Reportedly, the regime has around 100 to 400 atomic warheads. Recently, it was revealed by The Guardian that even though Israel is expanding the Dimona nuclear facility, the U.S. and its European allies have not shown any concern. Again, even though Israel has threatened Iran militarily. So while the U.S. is pressuring Iran to begin talks without lifting sanctions, Iran has started enriching uranium with a third set of advanced IR-2 centrifuges at its underground plant at Natanz, amongst other advances. Iran has also threatened to stop enforcing Article 36, only if all sanctions are lifted. And it is also said that it will further reduce JCPOA commitments soon if all sanctions are not lifted.
The future of the U.S. military budget hangs in the balance. This as President Joe Biden is following in the footsteps of his predecessor Donald Trump by refusing to cut the 2021 military spending. Officials have reported that Biden is postponing a reset of priorities as part of the Pentagon's expenditure, which is due on May 3rd. The budget will come in at just over $696 billion. That means the national security budgets, including the Department of Energy's outlay, could total more than $735 billion. The figure is comparable to the base funding provided to the Pentagon in 2021. Biden's decision is likely to draw criticism from his own so-called progressive supporters. But a major reduction in the budget is highly unlikely. That's because Democratic majorities in the House and Senate are slim, and not all Democrats agree to cutting military budgets significantly. That's according to Center for Strategic and International Studies paper. On the other hand, Joe Biden, like his predecessor, seems to have caved in to the military and defense contractors. Hence, no drawdown in the number of U.S. bases or troops overseas.
Those of us in the peace movement are very concerned about this because, on the one hand, he talked during his campaign and continues to talk about wanting to end these endless wars. And yet, if he's not going to bring troops out of Iraq or Afghanistan, how's he going to end the wars? We're also concerned about the airstrikes that have been going on because he has continued the policy of Donald Trump, which is not to publish any of the statistics about U.S. airstrikes. So it's not just the troops, it's the bombing that we want to stop.
American arms companies spend millions of dollars every year lobbying politicians and donating to their campaigns. According to figures by OpenSecret.org, top contributors to federal candidates, parties, and outside groups include Lockheed Martin, Raytheon Technologies, and Northrop Grumman, with each contributing more than $5 million. The total contribution makes up to $45 million, which has a direct impact on U.S. war decisions and troop deployments abroad. The USA Today has revealed Washington's so-called war on terror has affected 85 countries in the last 3 years alone. The newspaper also says over 19 years after the September 11 attacks, America is still entangled in conflict in West Asia and beyond, and there is still no end in sight to the unpopular wars.
It seems like no president wants to upset the status quo of the continued war machine. They don't want to go up against the weapons industry. They don't want to go against the hawks in Congress. And they don't want to be responsible for, quote, losing a war. But the U.S. has lost these wars a long time ago. And the only thing we're doing now is expending precious resources and lives in a continued failed effort.
But why does the U.S. insist on continuing these wars in spite of the fact that they have proven to be futile?
Well, in the case of Afghanistan, it's pretty clear that the Taliban control most of the country now. And if the U.S. leaves, because the government that the U.S. has been supporting for almost 20 years is very corrupt and doesn't have a large base of support, and the military that the U.S. has been training for almost 20 years is not capable of fighting the Taliban, the Taliban will have even more power once the U.S. leaves, and no U.S. president wants to be responsible for that. In the case of Iraq, it's quite similar. The U.S. is supporting governments that can't stand up on their own. And so if the U.S. leaves, these governments will probably be overtaken by other groups, and nobody in the White House wants to be responsible for that.
Apart from the suffering the conflict inflicted on target nations, the U.S. itself paid dearly for its wars. America has spent a whopping $7 trillion in taxpayers' money on the wars after the 9/11 attacks of 2001. That's not just about treasure, but blood. The U.S. has lost more than 4,500 soldiers in Iraq since 2003. The number of U.S. troops killed in Afghanistan as of 2001 stands at nearly 2,500. Those tallies are based on official figures. Some observers say the real death toll might be way higher. But there are no signs that the U.S. will free itself from the vortex it created in the first place anytime soon.
The U.S. airstrike against the positions of anti-terror resistance groups on the Iraqi-Syrian border last month has opened a debate on the presidential war powers, drawing criticism from several American lawmakers who argued that President Joe Biden must have consulted the Congress before authorizing the raids. But as Tulsi Gabbard, former U.S. Congresswoman from Hawaii, has pointed out, the bigger picture is being missed by many.
The regime change war the United States continues to wage in Syria, using al-Qaeda, al-Nusra, HTS terrorists as our proxy ground force, and who now occupy and control the city of Idlib.
Gabbard also drew a parallel between the crippling U.S. sanctions on Syria and the U.S.-Saudi sanctions on Yemen, saying the embargo is threatening the lives of millions of Syrians and preventing the war-torn country from reconstruction.
In terms of the attacks on Tulsi Gabbard, in my view, she's been attacked because she's anti-war, because she has been honest about U.S. foreign policy. She's been honest about the fact that the U.S. has been supporting groups like al-Qaeda and ISIS. She has called for the end of the U.S. forever wars in the Middle East. And that's the third rail of American politics. That's something that both parties agree on, that those wars should continue. And that's why she's attacked.
Since ordering the air raids on Syria, President Biden has also been criticized for keeping up America's interventionist policy in Syria and following in the footsteps of his hawkish predecessor, former President Donald Trump, who publicly bragged that the U.S. military was deployed in Syria to take the Arab country's oil.
And then they say he left troops in Syria. You know what I did? I left troops to take the oil. I took the oil. The only troops I have are taking the oil.
Biden's ordering the attack less than 2 months into his presidency has raised the question, is the U.S. West Asia policy ever going to change? The U.S. and its allies' support for terrorists in West Asia is no news, as many current and former American officials have acknowledged who has been behind a multitude of crises in the region. In a speech at the Institute of Politics at the Harvard University in 2014, then-Vice President Joe Biden painted a clear picture of what had been happening in Syria behind the scenes.
Our allies in the region were our largest problem in Syria. The Turks were great friends, and I have a great relationship with Erdogan, which I just spend a lot of time with. The Saudis, the Emiratis, etc. What were they doing? They were so determined to take down Assad and essentially have a proxy Sunni-Shia war. What did they do? They poured hundreds of millions of dollars and tens, thousands of tons of weapons into anyone who would fight against Assad. Except that the people who were being supplied were al-Nusra and al-Qaeda and the extremist elements of jihadis coming from other parts of the world.
Well, I think Biden ultimately would like regime change in Syria, though I think that he understands that that's probably a remote chance. I think that the U.S. will settle for the balkanization of Syria.
In addition, Donald Trump alleged in numerous instances during the 2016 presidential campaign that then-President Barack Obama and former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton founded the Daesh terror group.
ISIS is honoring President Obama. He is the founder of ISIS. He's the founder of ISIS. Okay? He's the founder. He founded ISIS. And I would say the co-founder would be crooked Hillary Clinton.
But not only none of those speeches resulted in any de-escalation in Syria, the U.S. exacerbated the situation further by pressing ahead with its anti-Damascus policies. One of the recent instances of which was Donald Trump signing into law the CSAR Act in 2020, which imposed a set of draconian economic sanctions on Syria. The conflict in Syria has left a trail of death and destruction in its wake. The West's sanctions and attacks conducted by Israel on the U.S. are hindering any attempts to rebuild the Arab nation.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 41 meters, 7,300 kHz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kHz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kHz every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5 and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Hi everyone, this is John. Welcome back to another episode of the Subcontinent. Our program aims to address important issues in the region of South Asia which affect the governments, people, organizations, and the region as a whole. We will try to explain, discuss, analyze, and break down controversies surrounding them and try to have some external perspectives from experts and people.
In this edition of the Subcontinent, we will talk about Chabahar Port in southeastern Iran and its significance for the Indian economy and politics. We shall also discuss India's prospects and challenges in the oceanic port.
Chabahar has been a key connectivity project for India because it can connect India to Afghanistan and beyond via Iran. India has big plans for Chabahar and has recently accelerated its efforts to make the project fully operational. But New Delhi should take into consideration a great deal of factors, such as the railway networks of Asia and the cost-benefit analysis of the ongoing construction projects in the port, as well as the repercussions of the comprehensive deal between Iran and China.
Located on the Makran coast of Iran's southeastern Sistan and Balochistan province, next to the Gulf of Oman and at the mouth of the Strait of Hormuz, Chabahar Oceanic Port consists of two separate ports, each with several berths, Shahid Kalantari and Shahid Beheshti. India and Iran first agreed on plans to further develop Shahid Beheshti port in 2003, but the project was stalled mainly due to US sanctions. In 2016, Tehran and New Delhi signed another bilateral agreement to create a momentum for the development of the strategic port. According to the deal, India would refurbish one of the 10 berths at Shahid Beheshti port and reconstruct container handling facility at the port.
For India, the Chabahar port is of great importance since it will allow from India's west coast, which is a major manufacturing and exporting area, to send stuff not only to Iran and Afghanistan, but beyond to the Caspian Sea into Russia. I think that was the long-term plan that exists. And this is not quite like China's Belt and Road initiative or anything like that, but this is also an opening up of West for India.
The agreement entailed $8 billion investment in Chabahar Port and its special economic zone, including an aluminium smelter and a urea-making facility. In December 2018, Indian company Ports Global Limited took over the port operations, and as of August 2020, the port has handled 1.2 million tons of cargo and 82,000 containers. India also used the port to send 75,000 tons of wheat to Afghanistan as part of the humanitarian aid amid the COVID-19 pandemic.
Chabahar is at the junction of important trade corridors in Asia, with the potential to serve as a connectivity hub from all directions along the east-west and south-north lines. However, the port is facing some challenges because for the transit of goods to be effective, the port should also be connected to the railroad network of the region. This means that all the regional players may have to prioritize their aligned interests rather than their rivalries.
Chabahar can provide an alternative route for trade between India and Afghanistan and accelerate and extend India's reach to Asian, European, and Middle Eastern markets. It is 800 kilometers closer to the border of Afghanistan than Pakistan's Karachi port. As a fulcrum of connectivity to Central Asia, Chabahar route will also reduce India's shipment cost to the region by 60% and drop the shipment time to half. India is also counting on a 900-kilometer railway line that would connect Chabahar to the Hajigarh region in central Afghanistan, which contains Asia's largest deposit of iron ore. The railway to Hajigarh can significantly increase India's trade because it connects to the North-South Transport Corridor, a 7,200-kilometer-long multimode network of ship, rail and road route for moving freight between India, Iran, Afghanistan, Azerbaijan, Russia, Central Asia, Turkey and Europe. With links to Bandar Abbas Port and Chabahar Port, Kabul is no longer dependent on Pakistan to reach the outer world. This also gives India access to Turkmenistan, Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, Kyrgyzstan, and Kazakhstan. India and Afghanistan also plan to extend rail route from Herat to Mazar-e-Sharif that is already linked with Uzbekistan and Tajikistan via rail, as well as with other Central Asian nations via road routes.
Iran, Afghanistan, and India should concentrate very much in making developing Chabahar Port into a major hub for trade from entire Asia, particularly Southeast Asia and even part of East Asia and South Asia, connecting that with Iran, Afghanistan, and Central Asia and beyond. And this will make Chabahar Port as important a port as Gwadar Port is going to be, or I think it's more than Bandar Abbas. This will be more important for the Asian, connectivity. And it will benefit all the countries, the region as a whole, because Central Asia's stability is as important to Afghanistan and Iran as Iran and Afghanistan's prosperity is good for Central Asia.
India is faced with many other challenges to actualize its aspirations in Chabahar and is deeply concerned about losing the competition to China, especially after Beijing's agreement with Tehran. Even before the deal, China had already invested a great deal of money in Pakistan's Gwadar port, Chabahar's sister port, that is often earnestly seen as a regional rival. Iran had even proposed to connect Chabahar with Gwadar.
Dismayed by the draft of China's 25-year agreement with Iran and hefty investment in Pakistan's Gwadar port, New Delhi felt the need for a more robust foothold in Chabahar and moved to speed up the implementation of the project. India's greater attention to ties with Iran is obviously seen by the back-to-back visits of the country's defense and foreign ministers to Tehran. Finally, India cancelled a $30 million contract with Shanghai Zhenhua Industries for heavy cranes, citing delays by the Chinese company in supplying the equipment ordered in 2017. Following a new tender for cranes with 65-ton capacity required for moving heavy cargo, the rail-mounted quay cranes were procured from an Italian company and delivered to the port around mid-January. Among the obstacles in India's path to realize Chabahar as the anchor for the expansion of economic relations is the sanctions imposed on Iran by the United States. Although Chabahar port has been granted a waiver, Washington's measures against Tehran are detrimental to economic relations, creating more setbacks for New Delhi and further rapprochement by its arch rivals China and Pakistan.
While the focus and thrust are mainly on connectivity and geopolitics, it is probably the economy that can make the countries of the region interested in the projects to develop Chabahar port. Cooperation and inclusion of potential stakeholders such as Uzbekistan and Kazakhstan, as well as Afghanistan, have already boosted international calls to expedite the project.
The first trilateral meeting between India, Iran, and Uzbekistan on the joint use of Chabahar port that was held virtually in mid-December marked a quick move in diplomacy. It was held a few days after it was proposed by Uzbek President Shavkat Mirziyoyev during a virtual summit with Premier Narendra Modi. The next trilateral is already in the works with Afghanistan. Uzbekistan is Central Asia's most populous nation with ample reserves of uranium, gold, coal, and oil. It can increase and facilitate its exports thanks to the port. Tashkent's interest in Chabahar port marks a flexing point in India's efforts to build a communication route to Afghanistan and Central India that outflanks Pakistan. Kazakhstan is also keen on involvement in Chabahar port. The envoy of the landlocked country to India has said the process has already initiated. Chabahar port also provides direct access to India's Farkhor Air Base in Tajikistan, another landlocked country in Central Asia which can benefit from the port. Moreover, several conferences and exhibitions have been planned to gather representatives from the Eurasian countries to the port. New Delhi's proposal to observe Chabahar Day was widely welcomed by all the involved parties.
The significance, as I said, is that India's access to West, and West, when I say West, it's not Europe per se, which is, of course, but Iran, Afghanistan, all situated of India's West, and eventually Central Asia, at least particularly countries like Uzbekistan, Turkmenistan, Kazakhstan, and these can be accessed to Chabahar port and then to Iran and then to Caspian Sea, or the railroad that Iran has built all along the western coast of Caspian Sea. India can send its material and their goods through there, and at the same time it is you know, it's a two-way route. So things can come in from Central Asia, Afghanistan, Iran, and Russia and Europe as well to India. And this is going to enhance India's capability to develop an economic and trade relationship with its Western countries, which they don't have any other way of doing it other than, as I said, you can do it by, they're doing it by Suez, but it's awfully expensive. And it takes enormous amount of time. This will cut down the time significantly, and it will also develop a very strong quick relationship with the Central Asian countries, with which India has only air connection, nothing else.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
Ladies and gentlemen, now to have more insight and analysis, we are joined by Dr. Ishtiaq Ahmed. He's a scholar and lecturer at Jawaharlal Nehru University. Dr. Ahmed, welcome to the show. So, what are India's hopes and plans for Chabahar Port?
Yeah, you know, this Chabahar Port, as far as our economic ties with Iran is concerned, it's very important. In the sense, India as well as Iran, both the country together, but mainly India, had been very deeply interested in developing this port for evolving a better bilateral economic cooperation between India and Iran. That's why it can be said that it's a dream project for India, in fact, and no doubt Iran had also been equally interested in having this project, and both the countries had been working for over several years in making this this project functional. There are other countries also, in fact, involved in the whole plan, the role of Afghanistan, as well as the role of Central Asian countries, even the role of Russia had been important. And if I recall correctly, all of them are working together for several years, and we had a big hope as far as this project is concerned.
So it's an important project, and many other countries are involved. You mentioned Afghanistan. What does Chabahar Port mean for the relations between India and Afghanistan?
Okay, of course, frankly speaking, India had always been interested in having good relationship with Afghanistan. We have seen the role of India had been very major in the reconstruction of Afghanistan, particularly after, you know, the turmoil and all that Afghanistan had been subjected to. So it was some 20 years back. I had been in the ministries. I have worked in the ministries. I have seen on the certain occasion that India had been contributing well to see that Afghanistan's economic condition improved. Afghanistan was passing through a very bad phase, and still there are many more issues. As you said, that why it is important. Okay, well, Afghanistan is important for us from the geopolitical point of view also. We are interested in Afghanistan. Government of India is interested in Afghanistan. Indian trade partners, businessmen, they all are interested in Afghanistan. But we do not have, a suitable route to Afghanistan. It can only be possible through Chabahar, because Pakistan is a factor between India and Afghanistan, and Pakistan never encouraged the idea of going to Afghanistan or having, you know, a better economic ties or better trade relationship as far as the route is concerned. Where is the route? We don't have the suitable route because of the discouragement policy on the part of the Pakistan. Had this not been there, obviously it was very easy to move our goods, move our containers, move our, promote our trade and commerce through land routes only. But it's not possible. Many times India has tried its best. Indian government has shown its magnanimity, especially I have seen the time of our former Prime Minister Atal Bihari Vajpayee. He took a delegation to Pakistan. But it has not worked in the sense there had not been encouraging response from Pakistan. Pakistan discouraged the fact that India and Afghanistan should not come closer. But I think as far if this Chabahar port is made functional, it will be very easy for India to have better economic relationship, better trade and commerce, better bilateral relations in terms of economy through Chabahar port, means through entering Iran through Chabahar port and going right up to Afghanistan will be the superb idea. And you know, the Afghanistan will be benefited, of course India will be benefited, and the role of Iran will certainly be very important here. Iran is also going to be benefited. This can be a good combination of the three countries.
Dr. Ahmed, our team has compiled a few sections of the media coverage in this regard. So I would appreciate that before continuing, we could take a look at it and then move on.
In a meeting with Pakistan ambassador to Iran in mid-December, the Director General of Sistan-Balochistan Ports and Maritime Department said that based on their needs and interests, Pakistan and other neighboring countries of Iran can invest in Chabahar Port without any restrictions. Chabahar Port is hub of bonding ports of the region with one another, he said, adding that strengthening connection of countries and their mutual cooperation is one of the missions of this port. Both India and Uzbekistan seek to achieve a bilateral trade turnover of $1 billion, but have actually reached only one-third of that landmark. A major factor inhibiting the development of closer trade and economic relationship is the absence of economic and efficient service connectivity. Both sides believe that the Chabahar route can be the key to address this problem. India's envoy to Uzbekistan, Manish Prabhat, has said that Chabahar can become a fulcrum of transit between India and Central Asia. A 70% discount on tariffs and lowering transit costs through Chabahar port have been so effective that Chabahar loading and unloading figure has reached to 2 million tons, while it was merely 200,000 tons just a few years ago, according to Iran's Ports and Maritime Organization. Many of the country's neighbors are currently choosing Chabahar port as their main trade route. The goal of the port is now to attract regional markets, including India and Afghanistan, and also the Commonwealth of Independent States, which can use Chabahar port to transit their goods with an average of 70% discount. Speculation is rife that the $400 billion deal between Tehran and Beijing could pave the way for China's investment in Iranian ports, including the strategic Chabahar port. India has high stakes in Chabahar and has been genuinely worried about China gaining foothold there, especially after unconfirmed reports that Iran dropped New Delhi from the Zahedan rail project and started negotiating a long-term deal with Beijing. It comes even at a time of heightened tensions between India and China following a series of clashes between the two armies in border regions.
Welcome back, Dr. Ahmed. So, continuing from the previous question, you said that Afghanistan is important because of geopolitics, economics, and of course, there's a huge Pakistan factor as well. But what about the United States and what happened during the elections? How will the Biden administration and its decision on Iran sanctions influence the future of Chabahar port?
No, of course, due to sanctions, anybody can see that there are certain things it's not going well, that there have not been sanctions. India and Iran could have worked more effectively, but due to sanctions, not only sanctions, but due to some restrictions also, and especially in terms of, we have some few years back, we have seen that payment was a big problem. Due to sanctions, the payment process is also affected. Banking thing is also affected. So India tried his best to do well and just to overcome those shortcomings, but still there was there. Had these sanctions not been in Iran, obviously India and Iran could have worked more effectively, and the result would have been better.
All right, so I understand that the sanctions are a huge barrier between Iran and India in terms of the Chabahar port. India hopes to keep China away from the Chabahar port. Can it succeed?
You know, it's very clear. Of course, China has no role to play here, to be very frank. It's in this project, if you look at the project, if you look at the, you know, partner countries, you know, there are, if I recall correctly, there had been around 10 partner countries. Small countries are also there. You know, there are many more Central Asian countries, and they had been working together. The role of China is not there. So it's not fair to say that India may not be interested in keeping China away. I think China should be away from these things, because this is a project between India and Iran and Afghanistan and the Central Asian countries, and even some country from the Russian part. So where China has the role? China has no role. So we should be very clear on that. China should not try to stop any sort of, you know, progress and development which is taking place or which is emerging out of our bilateral trade and commerce interest, especially with Iran or Central Asian countries and even Afghanistan. So I don't see that China has a role to play. Why should China should have a space here? It's not that India is trying.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, that was our show on the Chabahar port and India's prospects for the port. Until next time, Thank you and goodbye.
Start.
Movement.
Speed.
Live in hope.
Toward the peak.
On Youth Station.
Youth Station. Youth Station.
I am a Muslim.
I am a Muslim.
Islamite.
Islamite.
Allah my Lord.
Allah my Lord.
His word Quran.
His word Quran.
Muhammad Prophet.
Muhammad Prophet.
Praise be upon.
Praise be upon.
I am Muslim for all of
time.
By the first verse of the Holy Quran.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Allah will bless you.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Protect you.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Help you.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
So ask His blessings.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
His protection.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
His help.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Assalamu alaikum. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Youth Station. Okay, choo-choo ka-choo, it's the Youth Station for you. I'm Muzaffar Haidar.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, brothers and sisters. I am Zainab.
Okay, so the verse of the Quran. In fact, before we go to the verse of the Quran, because it's such a beautiful verse, I would like you to do the honors. But many times he doesn't answer our prayers. Who are we talking about here? He doesn't answer our prayers, sometimes.
Obviously not Bob the Builder.
No, no, no. Not Bob the Builder. We're not talking about Lat and Uzza. And we're not talking about the parents. We're not talking about the Pharaoh or any other fake gods. We're talking about the God, the one and only, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, our creator, the one who is closer to us than our jugular veins.
And the beautiful verse, which happens to be Brother Muzaffar's favorite verse, is Ud'uni istajib lakum.
Call upon me, I will answer you.
That's beautiful.
It really is. It really, really, really is. Call upon your Lord, my dear brothers and sisters. Call upon him, he will answer you.
But sometimes he really doesn't.
He always does. Okay, well.
Okay, let's define that,
okay,
right?
Okay, all
right.
Okay. So there's only Allah, first of all, let's get this very clear. Allah never, ever, ever says no to your prayer.
Ever.
He'll only give you one of three answers. Either he will tell you yes.
Really?
Or he'll tell you yes, but not now. Or he'll tell you,
I've got something better.
I've got something far, far better for you. Okay. So that's the first thing we have to understand and really, really comprehend this. I want to go into something a little bit deeper, but before we go there, let's get these basics down, right? So that's the first thing. Second thing is, tell me a prayer that you've made that hasn't come true. Oh, that's really personal, isn't it?
Prayer I've made that didn't come true. There's been a kajillion, but I don't mind it because maybe at the moment I felt like you can't just, you know, cut me some slack. I've been through 2020.
Oh, yeah,
could you
yeah,
please?
No, you have. We have to be nice to each other, guys.
Yeah.
Everybody should be nice to each other because we've gone
for
through
the rest
a lot.
Of time
yeah,
because we've been
time.
Through 2020. And 4 years of an orange clown in the office, so please. But it's happened very...
What is a prayer?
One thingy at a time, bro.
Okay.
But I don't mind it because there's a hadith, I believe, that if... So Allah never says no, right?
Never says no.
He actually never says no to a prayer.
No. This is just a philosophy that I'm building on. I mean, it's a
there's
theory.
A hadith.
I didn't, this wasn't a hadith that
there's
I told
a hadith
you,
that
yeah,
Allah never says no because he either gives it to you in this world or in the next.
Uh-huh,
so
okay.
For every unanswered prayer, you're going to get compensated for it and Allah's going to make up for it in the next world.
Yes.
So you're basically collecting coupons for yourself.
There's actually, very vaguely, I remember this beautiful hadith where somebody is given something extraordinary in the hereafter. They're given like a castle or something amazing that they could never have imagined. And they say, why am I being given this? And it's told to them that this is because you prayed for something in the dunya, but we didn't give it to you there. And you were patient on it.
Beautiful.
Right? Because of that patience that you showed and staying steadfast, we've given you this now. So
There is that idea, but again, that would fall into the third answer, wouldn't it? We have something better for you, right?
Yeah.
Or now, not yes, but not now.
Mm-hmm.
But let's break it down, really. What is a prayer, Sister Zainab? A prayer is a message that you have